From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump is hosting Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari at the White House. It's the first official visit from a head of state from sub-Saharan Africa during Trump's presidency, and it comes after those reports earlier this year that Trump referred to African nations with a vulgar word. Joining us now to look at the week ahead in Washington is Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So when the president of Nigeria arrived today, he and President Trump looked like they had a nice greeting. Is it going to be awkward after those comments about African countries?
Awkward behind the scenes, perhaps. There's probably not been any change in what Donald Trump thinks or what Buhari thinks. But for public consumption, we'll have these friendly gestures, as we did last week with French President Macron, who was very friendly with the president the day before he then went and trashed the Trump agenda in a speech to Congress.
Right. Well, I want to ask you about a lot of other things going on in Washington this week as well as we watch that visit by the Nigerian leader. Tariffs. There's a May 1st deadline, which is tomorrow, before some tariffs on steel and aluminum take effect. Are these likely to go through, or do you think that Trump will offer more exemptions for more countries?
It appears that the best answer changes from hour to hour. Mm. Overnight, the thinking was that there would be no further concessions from the United States side and that our trading partners were waking up. That was a phrase that was being used in a lot of places to the reality that Trump is, in fact, a hardliner. He does mean it about trade, and they were just going to have to knuckle under or go to war. Well, this morning we hear the Germans are talking again about some sort of new arrangement, improvements to existing deals. We don't have to walk away. We can work this out. So for the moment, the hard line of the White House seems to be holding firm, and the Europeans are going to have to decide when and if they're going to call the president's bluff.
The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has just finished a trip to the Middle East. This is his first trip as Secretary of State. Here's some of what he had to say at a press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We remain deeply concerned about Iran's dangerous escalation of threats to Israel and the region, and Iran's ambition to dominate the Middle East remains. The United States is with Israel in this fight, and we strongly support Israel's sovereign right to defend itself.
A lot of focus by Pompeo on Iran on this trip. What did he want to accomplish here, and what did he accomplish?
He wanted to show the world first that we have a new Secretary of State, that he is a very different breed of cat from Rex Tillerson. He's had far less history in the region, far less history of dealing with the oil countries, the Arab countries of that region. And he wanted to send a message that we are ready to revise and otherwise walk away from the Iran deal. This has been part of the Trump agenda pretty much from the beginning. And we are saying that we are committed with respect to Israel and the Palestinians to peace in the region, but it's going to be peace on Israeli terms.
Hmm. What about what's going on in the Korean Peninsula? Ron, sorry, we're bouncing all over the world here, but there's a lot happening and a lot of it in foreign policy. That historic meeting on Friday between the leaders of North and South Korea, President Trump declared on Twitter Korean War to end, but many people still skeptical about Kim Jong-un. What does what just happened mean for the potential meeting between Trump and Kim?
It would seem to mean that the President Trump needs to go through with the meeting. He can't very well back out now that we're on the brink of what appears to be a historic peace moment on the Korean Peninsula. And he can't torpedo what's going on between the South and the North in Korea if he wants to keep hearing people shout Nobel Prize at his rallies.
Hmm. Here at home, Ronnie Jackson, who was up to be the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs, withdrew that nomination. Now there are reports that he won't even return to his role as White House physician. Where are we with Dr. Jackson?
Officially, the White House is denying those reports. They are saying that Ronnie Jackson remains as assigned by the Navy at the White House. And the White House is saying that they will not have any more personnel announcements to make today. Which makes this a somewhat unusual day. But we've had so much turmoil in the first 15 months, people coming and going at the cabinet level, the National Security Council, the White House staff itself. So these Jackson reports are probably not coming from nowhere, and we may have more on that story as the week lengthens.
Well, do you think we'll ever know whether some of the reports about Jackson and, you know, drunken behavior at work, et cetera, are true?
I think we can know that those reports were not turned up in the vetting that had been done, and that the people who did that vetting have come back to say that they did not have any evidence to that effect. I don't think we're necessarily going to get to the bottom of why all those other people came to senators on the Veterans Affairs Committee and said that all these things had, in fact, happened with enough apparent credibility that the senators on that committee were asking really serious questions about Ronny Jackson.
That's NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, looking ahead to the week in Washington. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, President Trump's meeting today with the president of Nigeria is a reminder that the two countries are allies in the fight against the militant Islamic group Boko Haram. U.S. Green Berets have been in Nigeria this year training Nigerian troops. The U.S. also has troops in Niger, which many Americans didn't even know until four soldiers were killed there last October. Now, the Pentagon report on that ISIS ambush acknowledges a series of missteps contributed to the deaths. Will Wright, brother of Staff Sergeant Dustin Wright, one of those killed, spoke to All Things Considered.
The main thing is what we do next. And if it's looking for heads to roll and punishing people, we're going to lose sight of the true issues that we have as a nation. And that's standing behind our troops and being more engaged ourselves.
In other words, knowing what they're doing. Seth Jones is director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Seth, your reaction to what we know about this report, that mistakes were made.
Well, two things. One is I've been in the region recently this year, and there are threats to U.S. and other forces in the region. Second, I think one of the concerns I've had in looking at the after-action reports is that U.S. soldiers were meeting with individuals who provided information to some of the organizations that targeted U.S. forces. So we were talking to people that were providing information on our movements. That leaves a range of questions open about how well we knew who we were talking to. I mean, this is stuff that most U.S. special operations forces should be first nature where and the environment they're operating in.
Well, and what does it say to you? Is it a lack of intelligence or groundwork, planning, pre-planning? What's the solution?
When you're operating in a dangerous environment like the Sahel, I think it makes it really important to have the intelligence prepared well beforehand about who you're meeting with, to keep an eye while you're there on who they're talking to, both through signals intelligence means, if they're picking up a cell phone. I just think it means any U.S. operations in this area have to be done very, very carefully, because we know that people are willing to provide that information to terrorist groups that are interested in killing U.S. soldiers.
Well, and it's an area in which the U.S. military, incredibly equipped in many places, isn't as equipped here. We understand there's no real air base to launch a rescue, and the Americans didn't request backup from French air support for an hour after the initial contact with the enemy in this ambush in Niger. And it took another hour for the jets to get there. So communications is tough.
Yeah, the problem in Africa, including in this area of the Sahel, is that it's not Afghanistan, it's not Syria or Iraq, or even Libya for that matter, where any U.S. special operations forces on the ground are going to have pretty quick reaction forces, including medevac that can respond to troops in contact, which is what this was. There's less and less help, including air support for U.S. forces operating in the ground. So they really are in areas where there's much less background. And it actually, it's sort of bigger picture here. It's an economy of force mission, which means it's U.S. government has given fewer resources to these areas and prioritized others.
Well, it seems as if it's a sort of a domino effect. If you have an incident, a horrible incident like this, where there was no way to rescue these four troops, the U.S. is now building a drone base, at least, so that there might be manned drones that could come in. Maybe we'll build some other kind of base to launch rescue, manned rescue efforts, helicopters and things. The more deaths and casualties, the more there might be infrastructure. So it seems as if there's a cycle here.
Yeah, and I think the bigger picture for the U.S., including the U.S. military, is it's got to quickly decide how important this region is to the U.S. and how much some of these missions can be taken by other forces, including French forces. Because the U.S. is involved in countering terrorist groups in East Africa, in West Africa, in North Africa, in the Middle East, including Syria and Iraq, in South Asia, and increasingly in the Asia-Pacific region. I think in general, this region is one that if the U.S. can get more European help, particularly French, it would be better off doing that. And the French have been really important in dealing with some of these Salafi jihadist groups, including Al-Qaeda, over the past couple of years, including in Mali. I think that's probably a better way moving forward.
To address it in Mali?
Well, to address it with European help, particularly French help. French have a range of special operations forces that they've deployed into the Sahel. So how much of this can be burden sharing with the U.S., some of the U.S.'s European allies and African Union countries as well? I think that's the question before U.S. policymakers.
Seth Jones, director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Seth, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Some of us read obituaries. Attention must be paid, as Arthur Miller once wrote. And we're especially drawn to the younger faces. What happened? There was a photo recently of a smiling 20-something, Michael Cohen, a graduate of Pomona College, fluent in Mandarin, we read. He moved to Beijing, ultimately visited 27 countries. He'd then come home, fallen in love, the same solidly grounded and engaged person he'd always been. Then, we suddenly read, in December, he slipped into a depression and took his own life, one with so much accomplishment and promise, his death completely unexpected, a shock to everyone who knew him. We read all this because his parents and three siblings decided to share it, something they know may not be for everyone. We asked them last month to talk about why it was right for them, but they could barely speak. It was too raw. It's not that much easier now, but Michael Cohen's parents are here. Carol Cohen, hello.
Hi.
Nice to see you. And Stephen Cohen, hi to you as well.
Hi, Robin. Thank you.
We're a few weeks on. Stephen, start with you. Why talk about this?
We're convinced that Michael's suicide was preventable. Even though some depression was visible, there was a level below the surface that he wasn't sharing. And I think we feel pretty strongly that if you can eliminate the stigma and make it possible so that people are free to talk about what's really bothering them, that you'll save a lot of lives, and you would have saved Michael's life.
Yeah. And Carol, we've been doing some other reading. Julie Hirsch wrote in Psychology Today. She also had a suicide, her husband, and she did not say the word suicide because what if people think that as his wife, I maybe, you know, made him do it. I let him down in some way. And she pointed out other people maybe don't say it because some life insurance policies won't cover it or some faiths won't bury the person. And you're also in incredible pain when you're thinking this through. Mm-hmm. What were some of your worries, if you had any?
Well, we are incredibly proud of Michael and who he was as a person and everything that he accomplished in his life, especially the quality of his relationships that he had with other people. And we didn't feel that there was anything to hide about the circumstances of his death. Mm. We didn't even really discuss should we not include it. Mm. I think we just assumed we would.
Okay. No, I'm so incredibly proud of Michael, and I really admired him as a person. And why hide it? That was part of him, you know.
This was so compelling to read because you go on to say, since Michael's death, many have written about how special he was. They recall how he served as a leader and mentor for Jewish students in college, a role model. They marvel at his encyclopedic knowledge of music. I mean, the point you're making here is that this didn't define his life.
No, this was a temporary. You know, one of the lines that I've heard, and I'm sure lots of people have heard it, to describe suicide is that it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that line kind of haunts us because there's really nothing. Michael had some depression, for sure. You don't do this if you don't have depression. But also situational factors. We've sort of described it as the perfect storm.
Right. There were layers of events that happened at the same time at a moment that was particularly vulnerable. And it was really the concealment that killed him.
Others have written about this as well in the online health magazine The Mighty, an article, How It Felt to Read My Husband's Obituary Without the Word Suicide, because Charlotte Maya, the writer, did not use it for fear that it would, you know, her husband would be judged. But if you don't use it, then you're not conveying to people that it's a real disease, but also maybe reaching someone who might be having those same thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Michael was not at all the stereotypical suicide victim. He was not a drug addict, an alcoholic. He didn't have childhood trauma. He didn't have a long history of depression. He wasn't estranged from us. He didn't spend like the last 6 months in a dark room. He got up every morning and got dressed and took a shower. And, you know, we were certainly not on suicide watch for him.
No. What's been the response, Stephen?
Well, there are a lot of responses. So one, in the community that where we lived, so many people have said to us that if this could happen to Michael and to the Cohen family, we need to go home and check out on our own kids because maybe nobody's safe. And we've had a lot of people talk to you, and they tell you things that they wouldn't have told you before. So lots of people telling us about worries about depression in their own kids, and lots of people who've tried either attempted suicide or come very close to it and have come to us, and they want to share their story. And I think they want to share their story. It's interesting. The common denominator of their story is that they somehow made it known, even though they didn't want, in many cases, the treatment that they got. People are sometimes afraid that if you say something, you'll get a very intrusive treatment. You'll go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Yet when they look back, you know, they're sort of like, thank God that I was intervened with.
Well, I'm thinking too, you know, I can't imagine, this is all unimaginable, but what happens when you're part of a close community and you put suddenly or unexpectedly into the notice, then you don't have that relationship with your friends and your community. They don't know what happened and they don't know the pain you're in.
It's a really interesting question. You're hiding something and you're ashamed and they're a little bit removed from you because of that.
Yeah.
You're dealing with this incredible loss, and the thing you want most is people to reach out to you. And you might not want to talk to them, but knowing that they're there makes a huge difference. And anything that puts a wall in the way of that, I think, is very harmful to your own recovery.
Yeah.
I think you process it better when you're honest about it, and especially when you're not trying to hide anything,
right,
as we weren't about Michael.
Because then you've added that layer of shame.
Right, exactly. And there's no shame to this. There's
right.
tragedy, but there's no shame. We had a very private funeral for Michael, just family members, about 20 people. And then we had Shiva, you know, Jewish.
Sitting.
Sitting. And we had a lot of discussion about whether we wanted that because we weren't sure that we could stand being around people. And then it was actually very therapeutic to have all these people and distract, and you realize you're part of a community and realize there's a lot of love flowing your way. It was actually extremely helpful to have people know.
You know, it took us a month to write the obituary, in part because we really couldn't handle it. The level of pain that we were dealing with our own grief that we're still dealing with now, was overwhelming. And I guess putting it out there was helpful. But it also opened us up to a lot of people reaching out.
Yeah.
You eventually right. have to get it out because we process it every time we talk to someone who doesn't know. You know, and getting it out there, you know, helps that process for us.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, in this age of social media, we've actually had this conversation about, do we put something on Facebook about it? Layers and layers and layers of more people would know about it if we posted something about it on social media. And what that would allow to happen would be for people to process tragic information in private before then seeing us or deciding how to react, as opposed to having to just hear about it if we accidentally ran into them or were in a phone call. And then the other piece is maybe just putting some guidance out there about if you see us or talk to us, it's okay to say something about Michael.
I'm wondering, too, does it maybe even make you feel closer to Michael? Like you're not denying him.
Well, I would hate to deny anything about him.
Yeah.
Because it's not how I feel about him. Yeah, it's an interesting point. I said I miss him, like, terribly. But I'm not ashamed of him. And so the other thing, you know, I sort of come back to this point that, you know, if you have, you know, Michael would call me sometimes from China and say, I hurt my back or something. He's hiking or whatever. And you know, we'd have a conversation about, let's go, well, you should go to the hospital. Is there a doctor there? And he knew the people who ran the expat hospital. And so he would take care of that. And it should be just as easy to say, you know, something wrong with my psyche. I'm emotionally troubled and I need to see someone.
How are you doing, Carol?
Should I say we're a mess? Sometimes I feel like we're a mess, you know. I mean, this is pretty much the worst thing that can happen. It's going to be a really long time before we figure out how we live our lives.
Yeah, I mean, you're part of a new club, and people talk to you about things and in a way that you never expected.
We've been really struck by that. Like, people will call us up and say, I have to talk to you.
Well, and they wouldn't have known that you'd want to listen unless you did this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We got a call yesterday from one of Michael's very good friends, and he had written in an email to me that he had depression. He didn't understand that Michael did, and he wished they'd been able to talk. And I think he's been stewing about this for a month because he emailed a couple of days ago and said, I have to talk to you guys. And that's when he told us he'd had a suicide attempt and he'd been institutionalized, and he's made his way back. He's married and he's got a good career and he's on solid ground. And, you know, there are probably a lot of people out there like that, you know, who are harboring this, and they can only talk to someone like us about it because we can understand it. But it would be so much better if everyone could understand it.
Right. Stephen and Carol Cohen, their son Michael, died by suicide, and they revealed that in his beautiful obituary. Thank you so much for talking about it with us as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is May, also known as the 107th month since the economy has been expanding following the Great Recession, the second longest run in U.S. history. And our next guest says she hopes it stops. Wait, what? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
You know, you're just adding to my whole Debbie Downer affect, right?
Well, you had this confession on your blog, and we'll link people. You say you're rooting for a recession, you know, the economy to slow down. Why?
Okay, I don't want anyone to suffer. But, you know, the longer that this expansion and, by the way, the bull market continue, the more we tend to forget that these things actually end at some point. And this can lead us to make poor financial decisions, and it can breed complacency. And that's really the main reason I'm rooting against them.
It's a little teeny tiny recession, and the average is like a year. But you say we're way overdue. So what is it that you want people to do so that they can think like there is a recession coming, because it will?
I think you want to fight your natural tendency of always looking at the upside and remind you about the boring stuff I always remind you about. That's why I'm a certified financial planner. We want you to revisit and create a financial plan if you don't have one. We want you to have a healthy emergency reserve fund, maybe 6 to 12 months of your expenses.
Wait. 6 to 12 months of expenses.
Don't you hate me for that?
That's a lot.
It is. But, you know, if you're in a recession and you lose your job or your hours are cut back, you will be very happy to have that. Mm-hmm. We also want people to pay down that consumer debt. You know, a recession really does expose dangers of carrying too much debt. And of course, usually with a recession, not always, we get a bear market. So you want to maintain that diversified portfolio and don't forget to rebalance.
A slower market. And you say there's three reasons why a recession might happen. For instance, there's an external shock. You think of the OPEC oil embargo or the bursting of a bubble. We try not to think about the housing credit bubble in 2008, or an overheating economy, which it sounds like we're in right now, you know, which can drive prices up and maybe have the Fed raise interest rates. So if that's the kind of thing that might cause this next recession, when do you think it's coming?
You know, I actually don't think it's this year, although I wish it were this year just to get it over with. But I think that you are starting to see odds of a recession build because of that third possibility. In other words, the economy is not going great guns right now. Well, we just got the GDP report out for the first quarter. We grew by a 2.3% annualized pace, but that will likely tick up. We see prices are starting to rise, not just at the pump, but we see it in medical services going up pretty dramatically. So I think that that's really where we're looking. You know, the Fed is going to raise rates, probably at least two, maybe three more times this year. I think that next year could see the slowdown. And as you said, doesn't have to be long and painful, but it probably will occur.
Okay. Well, look, we said this is the second longest economic expansion in history. What was the longest and how did it end?
That was the technology boom, 1991 to 2001. 120 months. It remains the longest on record. And it ended when dot-com stocks started to melt down. That triggered a revaluation of every stock in the market and also a recession.
Well, it's because people realized that a lot of those tech companies and a lot of the stuff that was happening, they were just sock puppets. There was nothing to back it up, and the whole thing just blew up. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. A recession, she says, is probably coming. Get ready. We'll have everything at herenow.org. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
If you're a dog owner, you'll want to hear from our next guest. Maybe your dog is driving you crazy. Maybe he bothers your neighbors with his barking. Or maybe your dog just won't make nice with other dogs in the neighborhood. And despite obedience classes, you can't get your dog to behave the way you want. Well, according to our guest, Kim Brophy, maybe the problem isn't with your dog. Maybe you don't know your dog well enough to understand how to change his or her behavior. Brophy is a canine behavior consultant. Her new book is called Meet Your Dog. She joins us now. And Kim Brophy, you say the best way to understand your dog's behavior is through a system you call LEGS, L-E-G-S, each letter standing for a factor that shapes who your dog is. Take us through that.
So L is learning, and the learning is your dog's experiences and education in life. So a lot of times that's the primary cultural value we have, that it's, quote, all how you raise them. They're tabula rosa, blank slate puppies, and we can just make them what we want them to be. But then there's these three other legs that we need to talk about and consider too. So environment, the aspects of your dog's external world. So what's happening in a given moment and on a daily basis for our dogs as they meet the world that they're sharing with us. And then the genetics, the DNA that designed the dog on the inside and out, what we can see and what we also can't see, the genetic software. And then the self, the unique interior world of the dog, their health, age, sex, development, and then their one in a million unique qualities as an individual.
Let's talk about the learning part, because when I got a puppy, I read in this book, The Art of Raising a Puppy, which a lot of people who get puppies, they read that book, that the first 16 weeks are crucial for the dog, because the things that they learn in the latter half of that time period, they will remember forever. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yep, that's the critical socialization period for dogs. Now, it's not as definitive, black and white, like a line in the sand at 16 weeks, it's over. But it's flexible and variable among different individual dogs and then different types of dogs. For instance, Guardian, the giant breeds, that development is more drawn out and it's stretched out, takes longer, all of those different developmental markers. And we're still learning about those differences. But that critical period is very essential. And yet, it's interesting because the way that we've been approaching socialization, we've kind of had the approach to it like the more the merrier, and we'll just flood our dogs with all these sensory experiences, and therefore they will like them. And the reality is that for some dogs, the opposite is actually true, and that exposing a certain type of dog or a certain personality of dog to those experiences, if we're not carefully watching and observing, those socialization experiences can actually be detrimental to our dogs.
Give me an example of that.
So my own dog that I just got this year, I got a Guardian mixed breed dog. She's Pyrenees and Newfoundland. And as I was working with her, socializing her in my downtown location and behavior center and all these restaurants and cars and things like that, one of the things that I found was that she, in classic kind of Guardian style, was a little bit on the reserved side and a little more cautious than, say, a Golden Retriever or even my Australian Shepherd that I had in the past. And so when I would even feed her treats while while someone came up and offered to pet her, if they moved too quickly and they weren't reading her well, the next interaction with a stranger would be worse for her. And so as I was socializing her going forward from there, seeing that she was in fact true to her guardian self, I would not allow people just to come up and pet her, but I would rather invite them to invite her and completely leave it up to her, as opposed to even reaching towards her to offer her a treat. She needed a little bit more time than another type of dog would. And now she has no discomfort or fear around strangers. She just needed to go about that process differently due to her reserved nature.
What if you make a mistake in how you relate with your dog? Is it possible to change bad behavior?
In yourself or the dog? I think in both cases it's true, right? The cool thing is about learning. I had this realization years ago in my career. We think of learning like it's this mechanism that operates outside of evolution, and the actuality is that learning is the cogs and the wheels of evolution, because if things can't adapt to circumstances, if they can't change their behaviors and make different choices based on the varying pressures, then they're doomed. So a certain behavior the dog might have been born with as part of their genetic software, because that particular behavior was reinforced for so many prior generations, that in subsequent generations, it's going to die hard. It's going to be very difficult to modify something that has that long of a reinforcement history. Now, when it comes to something we've done with our dog, or some interaction we've had, or some habit that has set about in place just in the dog's lifetime with us, then yes, if we change the circumstances, if we change the environment, if we change the responses and the outcomes that the dog is getting, if we work to change the ideas that they're bringing to the table, then those things can shift. But you have to be really realistic about your expectations through that process, and also take full responsibility, as we kind of started with this conversation on that point, of we're half of that story. You know, we have to realize that what we want them to do is one thing, but what are we doing to actually create and facilitate that behavior? We have to modify both of our behaviors simultaneously in most cases.
You go through all the different kinds of dogs. I looked at the one that I have, which is a golden doodle, which it turns out, I didn't realize this, is a gun dog. It's called a gun dog. And you say that they're lovable because they're enthusiastic, outgoing, and cooperative, but they may be hard to live with because they're active, immature, and doting, which I think is spot on. I mean, is genetics the biggest part of a dog's behavior, do you think?
No, I think all four of the legs contribute equally to the dog's behavior. And I think what genetics gives us is just the point of reference. It's just the starting point. And then all of those other variables are going to play in as importantly. But if it's kind of like, I'll use the analogy, if you pick up a pen and try to make a phone call with it, you're going to be really frustrated. You know, you got to know what it is first and then go from there.
All right, let me go through a few specifics with you, just in a little bit of a lightning round. These are the kinds of things that a lot of people who have dogs may wonder. You write that instead of punishing your dog when he chases a squirrel, train him to come to you and the two of you chase the squirrel together. How does that work?
So that's about the PREMAC principle. And what we're doing is we're using the motivation that the dog already has as the reinforcement for the behavior that we want. So we're not going to compete with it with other punishers or reinforcers. So the dog comes to you, and then together you can chase the squirrel up the tree.
Especially if you're good at climbing trees, right?
You hope you don't have to do that.
What about during meal times? How do you deal with a dog who's just eaten but then comes to beg at the table when you're eating?
Well, you want to make sure you're setting up the environment so that the dog is not getting reinforced for that behavior. So if the dog is able to get scraps under the table, then that's going to accidentally reinforce the behavior. So
don't
give
scraps.
Tether. Yeah, exactly. Tether the dog on the other side of the room a few feet away. And if he's calm throughout the meal, at the end of the meal, he could have some table scraps. That's also the PREMAC principle.
Why do we train dogs to do crazy things like roll over?
I think for our own amusement, really. And, you know, sometimes they like it and sometimes there's an arbitrary piece of bacon at the end of it, which if there's no competing motivation might sound perfectly lovely to the dog. And some of those things are fine. You know, it's wonderful to teach a dog tricks. They can enjoy the learning process and the chance to make choice. You just want to make sure that they don't turn into our circus ponies in our living room.
If you find that it's just not working with you and your dog, is it ever appropriate to give the dog up?
I think absolutely. And I think that is one of the hardest things for us to talk about as a culture, because the greater solution that, of course, I would love, that I think we should all be working towards, is that we're not getting the mismatch in the first place. But just like any relationship, we might find that it is a star-crossed love affair where the animal's own best interests are not going to be in mind in our lifestyle and situation. And if that's the case, sometimes it's more cruel to put the square peg in the round hole than to try to find a square hole for that square peg.
That's Kim Brophy, who is a canine behavior consultant. Her new book is called Meet Your Dog, The Game-Changing Guide to Understanding Your Dog's Behavior. Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And I have posted a photo of my dog, Midas, not always well-behaved, but always cute, on Twitter, at Jeremy Hobson.
Nominations for the 2018 Tony Awards will be announced tomorrow. One of the shoo-ins for Best Revival of a Play is Tony Kushner's epic two-part Angels in America. It first opened on Broadway 25 years ago when the AIDS epidemic was still claiming lives at a frightening rate. President Bill Clinton had just taken office. The World Trade Center had just been bombed. Angels in America back on Broadway, and while much has changed, Jeff London reports the play remains eerily relevant. And a caution, some listeners might find the excerpts from the play disturbing.
Angels in America is subtitled A Gay Fantasia on National Themes. It takes on politics, sexuality, race, religion, personal relationships, disease, and death in a 7.5-hour play that veers from intense realism to wild fantasy.
It set an incredibly high benchmark in terms of originality of vision, moral gravity of vision, audacity of vision that no one's quite matched since.
New York Times drama critic Ben Brantley says the quarter-century-old play is not dated in the least.
What Angels creates is this climate of incredible divisiveness and fear and suspicion of people who might not be like us. And is there a possibility of reaching over that chasm? And I can't think of a more appropriate theme for this very divided time we're in now.
Tony Kushner began writing Angels in America in the late 1980s as people all around him were dying of AIDS. One of the casualties was the infamous Roy Cohn, lawyer and advisor to Senator Joseph McCarthy, who built his reputation going after suspected communists and homosexuals in the 1950s. Cohn himself was a closeted gay man, and one of the things that drove Kushner to write the play was Cohn's depiction in the liberal press when he died in 1986.
I read this obituary in The Nation magazine, which I'm a great loyal fan and reader of, that was really incredibly homophobic and ugly. And it sort of trades in the old theory that there's some sort of connection between homosexuality and fascism. And I found myself in a very strange place. I was very angry on Roy Cohn's behalf.
Homosexuals are not men who sleep with other men.
Broadway star Nathan Lane plays Cohn in the production.
Homosexuals are men who, in 15 years of trying, cannot pass a pissant anti-discrimination bill through city council. Homosexuals are men who know nobody and who nobody knows, who have zero clout.
Does this sound like me, Henry?
No.
No.
Roy Cohn's name returned to the news when Donald Trump was elected president. Cohn was Trump's lawyer and mentor in the last decade of his life. Marianne Elliott, who directs the revival, says Angels in America transcends the time period and the plague it depicts.
It's not just about that time. It also reflects very strongly on the time now. Because, you know, we're still in a situation, aren't we, where our governments are neglecting the vulnerable or not wanting to look at certain things.
Like Climate Change, one of the play's characters takes an hallucinogenic trip to Antarctica, and one of the angels of the title proclaims that people should not migrate. Playwright Tony Kushner says he knew these themes would resonate now, but he says the audience has changed.
Everybody, the young and the old alike, I'm happy to say, looked really pretty healthy and kind of there to see a production that they'd heard nice things about. And it was a different feeling in 1993. I mean, it's not that everybody who showed up to watch the play was terribly sick, but there were people in the audience, many people in the audience with KS lesions, people who were very emaciated, people who were clearly not doing well. And you also had a lot of people who were not sick physically, but who had just lost someone.
It's lesion number one. Look it. The wine dark kiss of the angel of death.
Oh, please.
I'm a legionnaire. The foreign legion, the American legion, legionnaire's disease.
Stop.
My troubles are legion.
Will you stop?
Well, don't you think I'm handling this well? I'm going to die.
The issues that affected the gay community 25 years ago were taken on by the ACT UP movement. But Kushner also seems to have anticipated the activism of today, says Scottish cast member James McArdle.
It's about, can we, as a political force, as a human force, as individuals, as a group, do we have the sticking power to change? Can we go through the really dark times and all the hardship that change brings about?
And despite its tragic themes, Angels in America does end with a message of hope. Playwright Tony Kushner reads part of the final speech.
This disease will be the end of many of us, but not nearly all. The dead will be commemorated and will struggle on with the living, and we are not going away. We won't die secret deaths anymore. The world only spins forward. We will be citizens. The time has come. Bye now. You are fabulous creatures, each and every one, and I bless you. More life. The great work begins. End of play.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.